Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We're going to skip a week on 1 Timothy, and I just a lot of the years I just kind of bypass Easter and the holidays and just stick to Bible teaching. A lot of times because of the very fact that we spend so many times, and I've gotten in trouble at churches as a pastor before, because when Mother's Day comes up, it's like, where was the Mother's Day message? Well, then the next week is Father's Day, and the next week is Memorial Day, and the next week it's like, you meet all the secular holidays and throw in the Christian holidays, Christmas and Easter and Passover, and not Christmas, but then you got Good Friday, you got New Year's message. It's like you've only got 52 Sundays, and the average Christian goes to church on Sunday, not Bible study on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night. And so that's why we have a church, a Western church that is totally ignorant of Scripture, and they can hear crap coming out of the White House about Awareness Day, and it's like, yeah, it's a great idea. It's like that's how pathetic we are as a culture and as Christians as a whole. And so I've always just kind of skipped the holidays. But then sometimes you get to a place like this where you realize, it would be nice to stop and talk about on the day of it, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Of course, it's the most important event of Christianity, most important event of our lives, besides the fact that we entered into salvation. But even as at times like this, when people are trying to hijack the Christian holiday, the high holy day of Christianity is being diverted into some perverted secular recognition, it's like we're going to stand up and say, hey, this is our day, and here's what happened. And it's not just a faith holiday, meaning, well, this is what we believe, we've chosen. It's like this is a historical fact that all of history, all of creation, from the whole plan of God, if you look back into the corridors of time, before time was began, it was pivoting around the resurrection, the crucifixion, resurrection of Jesus Christ. And it's not like a historical event that happened long ago and still has an effect on us. We're in the midst of the resurrection, ascension, and the return of Jesus Christ. The same way this Jesus was crucified, was buried, was resurrected, and ascended, he is coming back. And when he comes back, as we all understand, he's not coming back as the suffering servant, but as the ruling king, and not just as a local king, but as the universal king over everything that is visible and invisible. And the best thing a person can do at this point in history is get on the right side of history, get on the right side of God, and welcome Jesus and the resurrection into their life so they are ready for their own eternal future and also what God has planned for it. So what we have here is, again, the general story. I hope I can show you some things. And if you were here on, during Mark, we looked at some pictures. And if you were here last Monday night, we looked at some pictures. And so there's going to be recycling of some of the pictures. And just, it was either this or we're going to go through the qualifications of an elder in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And I tried. I was out of the deck studying yesterday, getting ready for, I can make this intro. I can make this. It's like, closer I got to, blast off time today, it's like, we need to talk about the resurrection and about Jesus Christ. And so, not that we won't, it's not important, but I guess I'm stepping into the very thing I condemned at the beginning of this. We're going to have a Easter service. Not Easter service. That's a way overstatement. What you have on your first page here as we look at this is the six trials of Jesus. Jesus went through six trials, and if I can get my... This is going to take a while because I didn't get this as organized as I wanted to. There we go. That's not bad. These are the six... Again, I don't want to go back too far, obviously, but Jesus went through six trials on Friday. Now, I'm going to say Friday because I think that's correct. I mean, I could get into a big academic debate, and you could say it was Thursday, and there's fair discussions about all of that. But there's six basic trials, and you can see one is going to be, it starts at about 2:30 Friday morning, a.m., and that's going to be at right here. I've got this map right here of Jerusalem. Here's the Garden of Gethsemane out here on the Mount of Olives. And if you're looking at this photo right here, we're standing on the Mount of Olives. You can see a tomb, a carved out tomb from the first century, and I'll show you a picture of that possibly, carved out of the bedrock there. You're looking down into the Kidron Valley, and so the Garden of Gethsemane would be on the side right over here. And that's where Jesus is at. He's going to be arrested, brought into the city to the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. He's going to meet before with Annas, and then he's going to meet with, how do you spell all this? Caiaphas. This is going to be the godfather. He was the high priest when Jesus was born, but he had so much power that the Romans removed him from office, and they appointed their own high priest, which was ended up being from the family of Caiaphas. Annas is still alive. He is what we will say the godfather. He is, if there's a mafia, which in a sense the priesthood is a mafia at this time, he controls the markets on the temple courts. He controls the markets here on the street by the temple. He controls the priesthood. And so, I don't know, it'd be like saying you've got a guy right here, a guy that's actually like the president, but the former president is actually running the show. Let's would say like this is Biden is president, but actually Obama is running the show. If that would be kind of the situation. Not saying that that's the case or Obama's the godfather or anything. But that's what's taking place. So they arrest him, and by 2:30 in the morning, he's brought before Annas and challenged. And then they bring him to the high priest, who's going to hear him. And then he's going to be taken to the Temple Mount, the Sanhedrin. So there's two trials there, about, let's say, 5:15 in the morning. So this goes on, let's say, 2:30 to 3:30 or 4:30. That's where you got Peter denying him and John being let in, all this kind of stuff taking place. We could read all of that. Then he goes to the Sanhedrin. And this is a quick assembly of something, because they can only meet after sunrise. So they're going to meet on the Temple Mount in some room on the Temple Mount. Of course, once they find him guilty, this is where the high priest tears his garments up here where it says, are you the Son of God? He says, you'll see me coming on the clouds of glory. And he tears his clothes, the high priest saying, we've heard it from his own lips. They're trying to get him to condemn himself. And basically he says, I am, and you're going to see me coming back in clouds of glory. They take him to the Sanhedrin, who then find him guilty of blasphemy, guilty of worthy of death, but they can't execute him. So they've got to take him to Pilate. Okay. And I've changed my map here over the last few years. I used to have Pilate being at Fort Antonia, which could be, but that seems like, as I've studied it more like a garrison, it seems like when Pilate would come to town, and he would be mostly over on the coast by Caesarea on the seacoast, he would come for the holy days because of all the commotion here, the governor, and he would stay at Herod's palace, which is right here on the west wall. Now, don't confuse. This is the western wall of the Temple Mount where they pray. This is the west wall of the city. You can still walk down here. You can even see part of this. Well, you can see this palace. You can even see the steps possibly on the outside of this wall where Jesus would have stood in that area where Pilate would have heard him. And that's going to take place, the first case, about 6 o'clock. So it doesn't take long. The sun comes up, they find him guilty, they send him across town to Pilate, and they want him to be condemned. Pilate asks him a few questions, finds out he's from Galilee. It's like, oh, good news. Always trying to avoid the political pitfalls, which everyone would do if they're a politician. I don't want to get into this mess. You're from Galilee, and so Herod happens to be in town. So we'd say about 6:45, he's sent over to Herod Antipas, who is to be staying at the Hasmonean Palace. Now, the Hasmonean Palace would be the Maccabees who took over, and they became the royalty and the priesthood. They were very wealthy, very powerful. But Herod married into that family, and so they kind of inherited this Hasmonean Palace. This is a very, very nice palace, and he would have been sent over. See, it's not that far. He would have gone over here, and that's where Jesus basically ignores Herod. Herod wants to see some kind of miracle and talk to him. Jesus just stands there and ignores him and then sends him back. He sends him back to Pilate, and that would take place about 7:30 to 8:30 in the morning, because as we know, the Bible's pretty clear, Jesus is on the cross at 9 o'clock on Friday morning. So he stands before Pilate, goes over to Herod, Doesn't get any response. Herod gets no response. Sends him back to Pilate. And Pilate then appears to the crowd and says, hey, he washes his hands. You know the story. Washes his hands and says, I find nothing wrong with this man. So Jesus has gone through these trials. Annas and Caiaphas, the high priest, could not find anything wrong with him. These people had to lie and make things up. Pilate is so worried about him that it's like he doesn't want to deal with him. Here, go over to Herod. Herod gets nothing. He sends him back to Pilate. Pilate says, the man is innocent, washes his hands of it, even talks to Jesus about what truth is. And Jesus, as you know, stuns him by saying, you know, guy, if my kingdom were of this age, my servants would fight. But it's not. In other words, Pilate, your kingdom and my kingdom don't even intersect. My kingdom is over here above this. Your kingdom is right here. You're fine doing what you do in your kingdom. If my kingdom were of this age, I would take it from you. But it's not. It's from another age. It's a different kingdom. And so my servants are fighting for something completely different. He basically tells Pilate, I'm no threat. And Pilate, who is a Roman, he's not as twisted and perverted as the Herods, and not as religiously protective as the priest. He's looking for justice. He's looking for Roman law. He's looking for truth. He's wise, and he realizes there's nothing here. This is jealousy. These are people coming against Jesus, and so Pilate says he's innocent. I wash my hands, and they won't let it go. So as you know, it's like, I'll set someone free. And they asked for Barabbas, an actual someone that was in rebellion towards the Romans, who'd actually murdered people, was an insurrectionist, some kind of a terrorist, the Sicarii. They were the daggermen. They would stab people in the crowds trying to get the Jews. It'd be like going into a mob of people and then killing a few people to start a riot. So the Romans would have to come in and put down the riot, which would then make all the middle-class Jews mad, and they would start a revolt against Rome. They've been trying to start a revolt against Rome throughout Jesus' lifetime, but it never could get started. And the Sicarii, which Barabbas would be one of them, would try to, they're like little terrorists that would go into a group of people, cause a commotion, so the Romans had to come in and overreact. And once the Romans overreacted, everyone would then fight against them. Well, that's who's in prison and who gets set off. And he is actually a criminal. And at 9 o'clock, Jesus is placed on the cross. Now, he's taken out this gate right here. The gate going right out here. Now, this is not confusing. And again, you may find it interesting. You may not. But we're talking about not, and we're not just talking about faith in the, you know, the Easter Bunny and Jesus and Tinkerbell. We're talking about an actual historical event that took place, that our salvation, that history is revolving on, that we're still waiting for a completion of it to occur. And so this is a real place. I've walked in these places. This is not like some speculation. You make, like I used to have Pilate meeting here at Fort Antonia and Herod meeting over here at Herod's palace. That's in the framework book. This is a change in the framework. I moved. This made no sense eventually. The more I learned, it's like that's a garrison. That's just like a bunkhouse for soldiers overlooking this. And Pilate is not going to go stay at the barracks. You know, he's like, you know, royalty, not royalty, but he's the governor. He's going to stay at Herod's personal palace. Well, Herod Antipas is going to stay at the family palace, which would be the Hasmonean. So that's an adjustment I made. So what we've got going on, instead of coming from here via Della Rosa, the trail, Jesus walking out here to the site of the crucifixion, he would have gone from here out this gate, and this wall is the wall of 30 AD. Eventually, the wall is going to be built out and around here before 70 AD, before Jerusalem falls, is going to be extended. So at this time, this is a road coming into town, coming from Emmaus, coming this way. And the Romans would have their public service announcements, like, these are the criminals, here's what happens if you disobey. And there's these guys rotting on crosses. It's like, whoa, okay, we better not speed in this city. We better not, you know, plunder a Target store. We better just, like, follow the rules, otherwise we'll end up on a pole here like these guys were. So Jesus taken out with two other guys that were scheduled to be executed and was put on a cross right out here in front of the city gate. Outside the city, but going to be inside, and it was a garden. It was an old quarry. They had gone through in Old Testament times, you know, like, you know, 200, 100 BC, and they were quarrying stones. There's actually good limestone there, and they're taking those and using them for building projects. Eventually, the quarry stones got poor. There's a crack going through it, so it's like, we're done. This is exhausted, and so they've got this quarry right here, and what they did, archaeology have found, that they brought in a bunch of dirt and created a garden there so they could grow plants, so it'd be like greenery. You're coming into the city, don't want to dump there. They've got like greenery, and then they turn it into a burial place. They started carving. You can't carve the rock for a limestone, but you can carve the limestone for burial benches and burial chambers. And so they're carving stones or carving tombs in there. And we can still see some of them right there. And that is where we come up with... That's what you see on that first page. I got a picture of some crowns of thorns. Let's see what happens if I get some pictures going here. This takes place right there. There's a map. There's the same map right there. There's the crown of thorns. I took this picture on the Mount of Olives. Those are thorns growing on the Mount of Olives. So they put a crown of thorns on him. It's like, well, where would they find that? I don't know, but there's some right there. And that I'm on the Mount of Olives walking by a tree right in the Garden of Gethsemane. So that could be, we don't know if that's exactly what they were, but we're not talking about rose thorns. It's not what I'm talking about. Oh, it really pricks my head. It's talking about, anyway, that's actual there. This would be a burial bench that is on a tomb. If I look down this hill, you can see one of them right here. There's three tombs. I'll show you some pictures carved into the stone. They're carved out of the stone. And you step into them, there's benches there. There's a bench going all the way, like a U-shaped bench going all the way around. And the body would be laid on that. And they're family tombs. So that whole idea of Joseph of Arimathea giving his tomb to Jesus, it's not like you're giving him your burial plot and your coffin. It's like you're not like, well, now where am I going to get buried? Well, the same place. Because they'd lay the body here, they'd take care of it, wrap it, they could slide it into one of these niches right here, and after a year, they'd come by and collect the bones and put them into an ossuary box. So that's exactly what everybody's thinking about Jesus. Joseph of Arimathea says, put him here. And he's fully going to come back later. The ladies come and put, you know, spices on his body. So you have as the flesh decays for a year, you've got that the aroma of the fragrance, very expensive and very powerful, so it doesn't, you know, have a hideous odor. Now, remember the verse, David talked about it, and Peter referred to it, that God will not let his Holy One see decay. And that's one of those prophecies of the Old Testament, that when the Holy One comes, he's going to suffer, he's going to die, but he won't see decay. Well, standing here, you put that in perspective, the Messiah is going to come. He's going to suffer. He's going to die. He's going to, like Isaiah talks about, he's going to make atonement for the sins. But yet David says, yes, but when he's dead, he's not going to decay. Well, what's going to happen? He's going to lay there? Well, he's going to be resurrected before decay sets into his body. Okay, so that's one of the tombs that would have looked similar to Joseph of Arimathea. I'll show you some more things. But this is actually still there from the first century. When Jesus talked about the religious leaders being like whitewashed tombs, he's talking about some tombs that we can see here. This would be one of them potentially. I want to show you this one. This is a very important one. This is inside of it today. That's Jesus' burial bench. There's a rolling stone tomb. You see it right here. That's up in Galilee. But that they found that they're putting a road. You see a road going right around here. I tried to cut the road out, but there's a road goes right here. They're putting a road in. And as you go by, it's like, whoa, here's a first century tomb. This was first century. This is not the way the Jews in days of Moses buried people. It's not the way the Jews in David's day buried people. It's not the way the Egyptians buried people. Not the way the Assyrians or Babylonians. This was something that they began to do in it stopped with the fall of Jerusalem, 70 AD. This form of burial stopped. And it had just kind of come in to practice with the rolling stone tomb. So that's an example right there. And then that's an ossuary box, as is these right here. These are actual, and I took pictures of these from the Mount of Olives. They've got them in little tombs that they found that just kind of sit around like artifacts. And some of them are decorated. Some of them are pretty plain. And this is where they'd put the bone. They're just long enough for the leg bones. The leg bones, they'd take and set them in there. And then they'd take that box and set it on a shelf in the family tomb. So when you go to the family tomb, like you go to a graveyard, you see the gravestones and the names of everybody in your family or whatever. You'd go here and they'd be on a, this is, you know, Bob's bones and this is Sarah's bones and this is, and they'd have, well, you know, a few years ago, you know this. I'd like to stop and show you more about this. They found Caiaphas's tomb. South of Jerusalem, like right here, go this way a little bit further. They're making a park. I'm pulling this off the top of my head. It had a road grader or a bulldozer or some kind of heavy equipment. And all of a sudden it falls in. It collapses in on a tomb like this. It falls in. And on the shelf were boxes, highly decorated, which right away they knew this is a rich person's tomb. This is not just the average, you know, guy getting his bones stuck in a box. And one of them, it had the name Caiaphas on it. And in there was, guess what? You lift the lid up. Oh, he did see decay. His bones were there with no flesh. And so they have his ossuary and they have his bones today. That's just flat out amazing. But anyway, these are ossuaries. They have found an ossuary that has got the name really, it became a controversial situation for a while because it's so spectacular. It actually went to court on a couple different occasions. The archaeologists, you know, everybody's trying to decide if it's legitimate. And what it says on it, James, brother of Jesus. On it, very simple, James, brother of Jesus. And right away, if you find an ossuary box or you find one of those rolling stone tombs, it's roughly from 50 BC to 70 AD. I mean, they did not do this in 300 BC. They did not do this in 75 AD because Rome destroyed Jerusalem. So it was a new practice that they were doing. So it fits in this window. So Jesus, the description you have in the New Testament is not going to be something they wrote in 300 AD or 400 AD because they wouldn't make sense. It'd be like us creating the resurrection account and describing the funeral and the burial process. It'd be pretty clear the way we talked about it. This sounds like, you know, modern America. This sounds like the 21st century. They're talking about digging in the soil, burying a coffin 6 feet. It's like, no. So what is described in the Bible fits this time period. Going back to the James ossuary, the big question was there patina in the carving of James, brother of Jesus? And that patina is that the growth that takes place of just the aging process. Because if you would have cut it in real clean recently, like try to doctor it up, you can't recreate that patina. So they've got microscopes and they've got everybody evidence. And after the court case and all the scientific evidence, they cleared it. It says this is, because again, you got value. How much is this worth? Who does it belong to? And they came out of the court case. At first, it was like kind of going to the negative side, but by the time it got done, it was definitely proved. This says James, brother of Jesus. Fitting this time, because James would have got pushed off the Temple Mound, is it 62 or 63 AD? Like we've talked about, off this right here, but on this corner over here, got pushed off and then clubbed to death. So he would have died right during this time period. And the other thing is, you don't write, and I'm not sure how close you guys are to your brothers and sisters, but you probably don't want, you know, the name of, you know, so-and-so, and then write, you know, the brother of, you know, someone else. It's like you're going to want your parents' name, most likely. I don't know. Meaning, if James is going to write, he should write James, son of Joseph. But who was Joseph? Everybody didn't know who he was. But if he writes, or if they wrote, and again, he didn't write it himself, James, brother of Jesus. Well now, oh, you're talking about Jesus. And so that's very unique to have brother of on. And nonetheless, I'm wasting your time, but that is just more evidence. Josephus recognizes James. Josephus also recognizes Jesus in disguise. So we are talking about not just Bible stories. We're talking about history, and it all fits into this. This is in the back of where Jesus' tomb is at. This is where they bury him. These places are called, here you go, the word is Kokim or Loculi, and that is that tunnel right there. That's what they're called. That's what they're referred to. You'd have the shelf, and then you'd have the Kokim where the body would be laid in and then brought out, and the bones would be collected a year later. Then you could slide the ossuary into the Kokim or the Loci. All right, here we go. Okay, this is a bad picture. I didn't transfer this one correctly. This is better of what we're looking at right here, and I'm getting ahead here a little bit. Let's go back to the notes. And on the notes, you can see that on page two is that whole calendar, map calendar, telling all the events of Jesus' trial, and he's in the tomb. And now on page three, and again, I would like to read all these verses, but I'm going to refer to them instead. The events of Resurrection Sunday. Now we're going from Friday, Jesus is in the tomb, and he's in the tomb before the sun goes down, again, on Friday night, or if you're going with a Thursday, crucifixion on before the sun goes down on Thursday. And so he's in the tomb all day Saturday, but then Sunday morning, now again, you all know this, but it's always worth referring to, Sunday is the first day of the week. Sunday is Monday in their world. They did not go to church on Sunday. They didn't have a weekend. The Jews had the Sabbath day, Saturday. And when the sun went down on Friday night, the Sabbath began. And when the sun goes down on Saturday night, the Sabbath was over. And so when Monday or Sunday the sun came up, it's heavy traffic, traffic jams, everybody's going to work, listen to your morning radio program. You're on your way to work. So it's Sunday. And sometime during the evening or the morning, before the sun came up, however this takes place, I've got them written down here, Jesus is going to be resurrected. Jesus is alive. And again, he comes out of the tomb. And again, when he comes out, he's spiritual in the sense he can walk through the stone, but he's also physical because he can eat food and they can touch him, they can feel him. So he has got a resurrected body. It's one of those things that we'd consider a mystery, just like the Trinity, to explain the Trinity, three in one. Well, we can talk about it, but it's beyond our understanding. We can talk about what it was like in before time began. Before time began, there was God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, God the Son, and they're what? They just sat there forever and ever. Well, no, they can't sit there forever because time hasn't begun. They're just there. Well, what's there mean? I don't know. My mind is trapped in time in a spectrum of going from this point to this point. I was somewhere yesterday, but I can remember it, but I can't go back there. I know I'm going to be somewhere different in a few hours, but I can't go there. When I get there, I won't be able to come back here. So I'm on this conveyor belt of time moving here, and I've got memories, I've got things I'm going to do. And so it's hard for me to explain, before time began, this is what it was like. It's like, well, there's no things, there's no material, there's no time, there's no gravity, what's that like? Well, you don't know what it's like. It's like, it's a world you can't describe. Now, Jesus is gonna come out of the grave resurrected in a physical body that's spiritual, that is unlike his former body, but exactly the same body, but in a resurrected state that's going to live eternally as a physical man. So he is God in a human body, in a resurrected state, in a body that is not going to die, that can't decay, but yet he can eat food, he can experience time, he can experience eternity, and he comes out. It's like, did he roll the stone away? Did he have to, the angels have to let him out? Or it's like, he's alive in a completely different dimension of which we are, in a sense, already part of. Today, we are seated with Christ in heavenly places, but yet we're all waiting for that day that we do die and have to transfer into that spiritual state and have a resurrected body. And even when we transfer into that spiritual state after death, we're still waiting for the great resurrection. There's still a day coming where everyone will rise from the dead. So there's many things going on here as we look at this that I don't think it's wrong to just identify it as a mystery. I understand this. Now I'm showing you some hardcore structures, rocks, tombs, ossuaries. We got historical facts. So we're talking about real things, but what takes place here is the universe is revolving around these events beyond anything we can understand. Okay, the events of Resurrection Sunday. This would be the day we're celebrating right now. About 4:45, now that is not a biblical time, but you got the sun coming up, and the Gospels record the women left when it was dark. And then here's the skeptics. Well, one gospel says the women were going to the tomb and it was dark. Another was talking about the sun was up. Well, that's never been a problem for me because I used to have a paper route when I was a child. I would get up and deliver papers beginning in the morning in the dark. And by the time I got home, the sun was up. And so it's like, well, I thought you said it was dark. Well, it was, but the sun is coming up, so it's going to get brighter and brighter. It's going to be day. And so if you want to be a stupid skeptic, well, look, the Gospels don't even agree. Well, one's writing, the women leave in the darkness, and as they got to the tomb, the sun was rising. It's like, how's that happen? Well, let me tell you about a paper boy. It's not, if you've ever got up, maybe you sleep too late, but about 4:45 a.m., so you can look at right around the time. And we do know the day of this because we can match it to, and again, this is a big deal, but yet it's not, is it's happening on Jewish holidays. It's happening on Passover. It's happening on unleavened bread. Thank you. And these are happening on holy days, which would be nice if we would keep them on those holy days, that we would celebrate the Last Supper, the resurrection, the crucifixion, on those days of the Passover feast, so we could keep it in context, because all those Jewish feasts were real, talked about a historical event in remembrance of the Exodus or whatever, but we're also pointing towards an ultimate fulfillment in the future. And this resurrection is one of the ultimate fulfillments of what was prophesied. Now, there's other feasts that are yet to take place, which you should put in your notebook. These feasts haven't been fulfilled prophetically. They've happened historically. They've been celebrated and are being celebrated, but yet that fulfillment hasn't happened yet. Well, maybe you should stay in tune, because if all these other events are happening on holy days of the Jews, will the other events happen on those days also? I don't know. Nonetheless, we know from Bible class on Monday nights, the Roman Catholic, or the Roman Church, before they were Catholic, they wanted to celebrate it Easter on the first Sunday after the equinox of March, unless that equinox was on a Sunday, in which case it would be the Sunday after the Sunday of the equinox. And so that's the day. But the Asian Christians, like John, Philip, and those churches that they established, including Polycarp and Papias, they celebrate it like the apostles taught them, on the Jewish holidays, on Passover, which means, just like Christmas could be on a Monday or a Tuesday or a Thursday, and so they're celebrating their holy days, or their Easter, so their Good Friday and their Easter celebrations. Maybe they'd start fasting on Monday and then break their fast on Wednesday. The next year it might be Tuesday to Thursday. And Rome, for some reason, couldn't stand that. The local Roman church is like, we've got to have it. And again, it makes sense. We want to celebrate Jesus' resurrection on the day of the week, Sunday. But if we were following the Jewish calendar, we would be celebrating Easter sometimes on a Wednesday, sometimes on a Thursday. It's like, would that be strange? Well, it'd be a lot like Christmas. You know, it's like, it's on the 25th. It's always on a Saturday. It's like, it's around the calendar, so we would adjust. But they were so adamant about it that there was a church division, there's a church split, and the Council of Nicaea, when they decided that, you know, Jesus was the Son of God, eternal Son of God, not Arius, but Athanasius Creed, they also brought in and says, we're going to affirm this belief, or this, that the church is going to celebrate Easter on the first Sunday after the equinox, unless the equinox is on a Sunday, in which case it'll be on the Sunday after the first equinox on a Sunday. And so that's why we're all over the calendar, and yet we're standing here when we get all done celebrating. Passover's here in a couple weeks yet in April, because it's always on in Nisan. Nonetheless, Sunday is when this happens, and Sunday is what we remember. So, is that a big deal? No. Is that a big deal? Could be. It's like, it decides on where you want to come down on it, and I could argue that it doesn't really matter, Or I could build a case that it's a big deal because we've screwed up the... Remember, the sun and moon and stars were put in place to mark seasons. And that word seasons is the same word Moses established the feast, the seasons. So they're put in place to mark the feasts and the seasons. And then we say, oh, we would rather have it be on Sunday. It helps out for the marketing. It's like, well, again, that's not the reason they did it. One of the reasons the Roman church did this is because if the Asian church started celebrating it when they did, they would be fasting for a couple days, and then on the day of the resurrection, breaking their fast, having a feast, celebrating the resurrection. Meanwhile, across the sea, Rome is still like in sackcloth and ashes and fasting. It's like, it's not right for us to be fasting while you're celebrating the resurrection when we're still waiting for the resurrection. It's like, you don't even have cell phones. I mean, no one's even posting this. How do you know? You know, now in our world, it's like people are, oh, happy Easter. It's like, oh, no, we're still mourning. So, I mean, in the age of social media, I could understand it. But, 150 AD, it's like, let it go. Okay, that's my beef on the date. Okay, so about 4:45, women leave Bethany for the tomb while it is still dark. That's in Luke, Mark, and John. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, Salome the mother of James and John, they are the ones that show up. And a lot of these are relatives. These would be like Jesus' aunts. At sunrise, about 5:15, there is an earthquake, which if we were to put a time on the resurrection, we would say 5:15 on that Sunday morning, because there's an earthquake. Jesus is raised from the dead. I write that. The Bible doesn't say he was raised from the dead. I'm putting that in there. Meaning as the sun was just coming up, there's an earthquake, and that is the resurrection. An angel rolls the stone back. That's in the text. The soldiers see the angel and fall down. Their fear temporarily immobilizes them. Then they run off to report the event to the priest. Now, this story is surrounded with evidence of legitimacy. The fact that the soldiers, there's no execution of the soldiers, the fact that the soldiers report, the report that the priest tried to cover it up, because were there any eyewitnesses of the resurrection? Roman soldiers. And they would have gone and says, oh, this just happened. And that truth, just like any time the word, the truth is spoken, is going to have an effect on your heart. Whenever the truth is spoken. So when they come and say, this is what happened, and the priests hear it, they don't report to their supervisors, they report to the priest. What are we going to do? And the priests now get not a testimony from Peter and James and John or the women. They get a report from the tomb that this happened. And we fell down. It's like we were paralyzed. And there's still probably some sign of fear in their story because it's just been a few moments. And the priests are going to say, we got you covered. Just say you fell asleep and we'll grease the wheels from there. Now, that would be execution. Just say you're a loser. Just say you're a loser as a Roman soldier and you fell asleep on the job. But we'll make sure that gets passed. I mean, just take it and present us with a crappy policy that's destructive to everybody, but we'll make sure it passes. And that's exactly what they're doing. So these guys have to come and say, we fell asleep and he escaped. Okay, well, that still doesn't make sense. Or we fell asleep, we were overpowered by these three fishermen. Well, no, if you go back to the story, the fishermen are hiding because they're the next ones to get tacked up. Who's coming is the women. So the women overpowered you? Oh man, this is not really sounding very good. It's like, but nonetheless, they had it covered up. Okay. Mary Magdalene runs ahead to the tomb to get someone to roll the stone away, which once again shows the tremendous faith that they've got. She runs ahead to make sure that Jesus is already alive. No, she runs ahead because the women are going, there's no way we're going to be able to move that stone. So Mary goes ahead to see if she can line up some help to get the stone moved so they can get to work right away. And so is there any sign that any of the apostles or the followers are like, well, no, I'll just wait here because I know Jesus is going to come back alive today. The men didn't believe it. The men were afraid that they're going to die. The women were going to the tomb to put ointment on the body because he's dead. In fact, he's so dead, we need someone else to move the stone for us to get into his dead body. So no one's going out there prepared for a hallucination. It's like they're going out there to see a stone and a dead body. And when they get there, it's not at all what they expect. So this, well, they imagined, they fantasized, they wanted to be, you just think, I want it to be true, I want it to be true. They weren't even thinking it to be true. They're thinking, Jesus is dead, now what do we do? So it's not, we're not making fun of them. We're not saying they don't have faith. We're saying just like you and I, they're confused. I believe, but none of this makes sense. This is what I believe. I trust God, but everything on the ground here looks like nothing's true. But I'm going to continue to follow, and all of a sudden things start happening. So there's several things in here that make it, that this is not a fabricated story. Nonetheless, Mary runs ahead to get the tomb open. Mary finds the tomb open. John 20, verse 1, she gets it, the tomb is open. Mary runs to tell Peter and John in Jerusalem. So she runs to Peter and John, who are in Jerusalem, praying and fasting and waiting for the resurrection. No. They may not have slept that night. They're probably taking turns watching the house or the door, making sure they don't get arrested. About 5:30, the other women, Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, complete their walk from Bethany and arrive after sunrise. Again, they're walking a couple of miles. So to leave in the dark and arrive after sunrise is not even a difficult proposition. They enter the grave because the stone's been moved and find it empty. An angel appears to the women at the tomb. So they walk in and they're like, what's going on? Now an angel pops up and appears to them. The angel gives the two women a message for the disciples. The women leave to tell the disciples. They turn and go back. Now they're going to go into Jerusalem. And again, this is an amazing thing. The angel gives the women a message to tell the apostles. So you just got to play that into the whole formula of women teaching, talking to men. It's like, well, the angels are not afraid of giving a message to a woman to tell a man what God is saying, especially when the man is hiding. And you go back and I can push that. Every time you have God having to appear to a woman to go tell a man something, the man's usually hiding somewhere. He's hiding in a wine press, or he's hiding and doesn't want to go to battle against the Canaanites like Deborah. And she goes, well, she says, okay, because you're afraid to go, a woman's going to kill the general. Said, you are the man that's going to, you're going to go kill the Canaanite general. Yeah, I ain't going to go unless you go. Deborah, you coward. Because you won't go, a woman will do the work. And that's when Jael pins the general's head to the ground with a spike. And it's like, why is that? Well, because it's like God maybe has chosen the men to do it, but eventually men get too afraid, too cowardly, too overcome. And it's like, would you, honey, would you go take care of this? And they do. It's like, well, God can use a woman, especially when a man's hiding in a wine press or hiding behind a woman or hiding behind a door. The women are over here moving stones and going to the body, and the men are like, oh. So, again, don't take too much out of that, but just consider what I said. we could turn this, it could be Women Appearance Week. Women... What's that word? Appearance? Right, not recognition. Visual, you know, that's going on with the... Yeah, what's that day?
Awareness.
Oh, not, it's not awareness. Isn't it? Is it awareness? I thought it was like visually seeing him. Okay, I'm trying to be... Visibility. Yeah, see? Easter is Women Visibility Day. I'm trying to be funny and going downhill fast. Don't be humorous during an Easter message. Okay. Angel gives women a message for the disciples. Peter and John have heard Mary's report. They run to the tomb and find it empty. And again, what's interesting in the book of John, remember what it says right there, John reports that John got there first. I mean, John's right. He says, and John arrived, the one disciple Jesus loved, got there first, which I'm not sure why he wrote that, but I know why I would write that. If me and Pat were going, I'd say, me and Pat were running, and I got there first. Just to let you know. They run to the tomb and find it empty. Mary Magdalene follows them back to the tomb. Mary Magdalene has arrived at the tomb. Peter and John have gone back into Jerusalem. Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene in the garden by the tomb. So the disciples, they get there, they see it, and they leave to go back to tell the other disciples. Mary's still there at the tomb, and that's where Jesus appears for the first time to someone. He appears to Mary. Jesus appears to the other women, Mary, Salome, Joanna, as they were on their way to see the disciples. And then Jesus, on point 12, Jesus appears to Peter. That's in Luke and recorded in 1 Corinthians 15. Sunday afternoon, Jesus appears to two men on the road to Emmaus. And we had a map up here of the road going to Emmaus. So they're walking. Jesus walks with them. They don't recognize him, as you know, the story, until they sit down to eat. And he breaks the bread. They recognize. And then he disappears. Again, this was not something Jesus did during his lifetime, just, you know, disappear on people. But now he's appearing, disappearing, traveling, you know, at the speed of thought, speed of light, with a price, speed of thought. 14, Sunday afternoon, Jesus appears to 10 of the disciples in the upper room, and Thomas is absent. Obviously 10, because Judas is no longer available, and Thomas is absent. The other resurrection appearances in the scriptures of Jesus, 1 week later, Jesus appears to all 11 disciples, and Thomas is there and believes, which again is an interesting conversation. I mean, it's like, he says, touch me. I mean, it's like, Thomas needs some proof, and Jesus is not afraid to give, go ahead and touch me. He says, I have flesh and blood. Jesus appears to 7 disciples on the Sea of Galilee, and that was the original command, and I still haven't totally figured that out, but go tell my disciples, I will see them in Galilee. So in other words, the women's message was, tell my disciples I'm going ahead of them to Galilee. I mean, there's nothing about popping in on you here on the road to Emmaus. I want to see you in Galilee. And so finally, after all of these other appearances, they finally go to the Sea of Galilee. And they appear, or Jesus appears to the disciples on the Sea of Galilee. Jesus appears to the 11 disciples on the mountain, on a mountain in Galilee. That's in Matthew 28, 16. Jesus, according to 1 Corinthians 15, 7, Jesus appears to his brother James. And 19, Jesus appears and teaches his disciples in Acts chapter 1. And Jesus appears at his ascension. So in Acts chapter 1, you can put those two events together, but he may be teaching them. But there also is, he appears at the ascension. And that is his appearances. Jesus appears to people after his resurrection. Here's a list going all the way down. And you've got, go down to like the 10 disciples, like 6-7 lines, 7 disciples of Galilee. Oh, I'm about halfway down. To more than 500 believers, 1 Corinthians 15, 6, there's a time that is not in the Gospels that Paul says that Jesus appeared to more than 500 at one time, which again is not, you can have someone have a hallucination, but you can't have 500 people see the same thing. And Paul says, when he's writing 1 Corinthians, which is 55 AD, he says, and many of them are still alive. Meaning, he's telling the Corinthians who are doubting the resurrection, because the Corinthians they believe in Jesus' resurrection, but they want to make it all spiritual. They're having a hard time that this was a physical resurrection and that we will be physically resurrected ourselves. And Peter says, well, this is the case. That's the gospel I preached to you. That's the gospel you believed, and that's the gospel that saved you. Now, to go back and change that means you're nullifying the power of the gospel that you believe. But he appeared to 500 that were still alive. So you can go check with these. He would be telling them. James, the Lord's brother, is listed. The 11 disciples in Galilee. The 11 disciples at his ascension. He appeared to Stephen at his martyrdom. He saw Jesus. He saw him in a vision. He appears clearly to Saul or Paul on the road to Damascus. He appears to Paul in Arabia, according to Paul's teaching himself, that somehow Jesus was in communication with him while he was in Arabia. He appears to Paul in the Jerusalem temple in Acts chapter 22, where Jesus makes some kind of an appearance to Paul. He appears to Paul in the prison in Caesarea, Acts 23. And he appears to the Apostle John in Revelation 1. Those are the scriptural accounts of Jesus appearing to the someone. On the next page, page 4, I don't have time to do a good job with this. I actually cut and pasted this just off of a website. And it gives you all the sources. But I just gave you a list of biblical references of Jesus' resurrection that you can test and look at the storyline. But these are people who wrote early in the first and second century that are writing, and the only way their story makes sense is if the resurrection was true. And they write about it. Thelos, a historian who wrote about the eclipse of the sun in 55 AD, appears to be trying to make a connection that was the eclipse that happened at Jesus' crucifixion. Pliny the Younger, we studied this a few weeks ago when he's writing back and forth to Emperor Trajan. We've got their letter. We've got the letter from Pliny to Trajan, and we've got Trajan's written response. And they're talking about how to deal with Christians. The lives of the Caesars. It says in the book of Acts that Aquila and Priscilla had been driven out of Rome because of Claudius's decree that the Christians had to leave, or the Jews had to leave. Because of the commotions that were taking place in the synagogues in Rome, the Jews could no longer be there. And probably the commotion was that very thing that we saw many synagogues split was the arrival of the gospel and the resurrected Messiah to the Jewish synagogue. Some would believe, some would totally reject it, and now you've got this infighting, and it became violent. And so the Jews all have to leave, and that's why Aquila and Priscilla end up in Ephesus or Corinth. And that is recorded by Suetonius. He says right there, it's written here, expelled the Jews from Rome because of trouble caused by Crestus, which historians believe is a misspelling of Christ. The Jews were driven from Rome, Aquila and Priscilla themselves, it's recorded in Acts that they were driven from Rome with all the Jews, and now the Roman historian writes, why were they, because of Crestus. Crestus was dividing all these synagogues. Well, they think, everyone agrees, that Crestus is their way of saying Christos, the Christ. Again, they had very little understanding of what was going on, we just know it's that Christos guy, and it's like they didn't know he was dead and resurrected, but anyway, that's they record the same thing that Acts records. Now you can imagine if it's a fiction, it's a fairy tale. How did it make it all its way to Rome, where the synagogues were splitting, and the Roman emperor had to make a decree on his city because of the resurrection? And that's again a very huge case. You got some other ones going down there. You can read those, but including Josephus. Josephus. I got on page six. About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man. This is in Josephus, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Christ. And when upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had condemned him to a cross, those who had first come to love him did not cease. He appeared to them, spending a third day restored to life, for the prophets of God had foretold these things and a thousand other marvels about him. And the tribe of the Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. And that would be Josephus writing after 70 AD, sometime between 75 and 90 AD. Some people think that was implanted, or what do you call it, written in there by Christians later into his text. The problem with that is you've also got Josephus written in Aramaic, and it's in that also. So it'd be written by people that were not Christians, and it was in their text. So you get, it looks like it was just written in sometime later. They make that up because it's such a profound statement. It's like, that can't have been written by Josephus. Well, it actually can't. Everything he says would make sense to Josephus's mind in his worldview, being a rabbi, being a general, being familiar with these events, especially seeing the church in 70 AD had already left Jerusalem, and he was in Rome, and there's a church in Rome. So there's no way he would have known all of those things. But the fact that it's also in other languages that the Christians would not have had access to that literature, it written the same way, it really makes it look like it's Josephus's original words, which is a huge testimony. There's really no way to discount these things. Then what we've got here on the rest of these pages, I'm going to flip through these pictures here. This is the wall of 30 AD. This would be outside. This would be the road coming into the gate. This would be the quarry, the hill, the quarry that was abandoned. This would be the tomb right here, cut into the... And I'm going to see this A right here. There, I'm going to show you these tombs. I can still show you these tombs are still there in the back of this quarry right here. Now, I'll show you the pictures here in a moment. This is not in the right order. But the cross would have been right here. Jesus' burial tomb would have been back here in this stone. Now, in 70 AD, Jerusalem was destroyed. They came back, they rebuilt, and by 132, the Jews start a second revolt against the Romans, and that would be where Vespasian comes in between 132 and 135 and has to defeat the Jews a second time, which is amazing. I mean, how can you recover that fast? And the Romans have to lay down legions of troops, gave their lives to destroy Jerusalem a second time. Well, Hadrian is so finished with the Jews that he destroys all their holy sites, plows the city. The Jews can't come back into the city. It's illegal to be in the city if you're a Jew. So it becomes totally Christianized, or it had been. But this was a holy site, and he builds over the top of this a retaining wall. Just like this is a retaining wall, the Temple Mount is a retaining wall. See, that's Mount Moriah, goes up like this. Then they build a retaining wall and filled it in to make it flat. This right here, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, anytime there's an earthquake, this stuff underneath, this is sitting on the dome of the rock. It's sitting on the top of, so when there's an earthquake, it just rides it out. It's on bedrock. This is all fill. You see how it tapers down? So this right here is all fill. So when there's an earthquake, this always collapses or has heavy damage because it's sifting the debris that it's setting on. Does that make sense? And so they have found pillars in there, beams in there from 1000 BC, which looked like they're beams from Herod's Temple, or Solomon's Temple Mount, and also Herod's Temple Mount. There are ancient 2,000, 3,000-year-old beams from Lebanon in there. Some of them have been burnt. We talk about that later. But nonetheless, that's a retaining wall. Hadrian builds a retaining wall around Calvary, this whole thing, builds a platform, and over the top of the crucifixion builds a temple to Venus and builds a temple to Jupiter over the burial place. That's what takes place there. Now, Constantine is going to come in, and he's going to ask the Christians in 325, he's going to ask, where's the Jesus crucified? And the Christians are going to point right there. They're going to say that was the place. And it's a pagan shrine. Now, by that time, that place is inside the walls of Jerusalem. The Bible clearly says Jesus was crucified outside the walls of Jerusalem. See, right here is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre right there. See, Jesus was crucified right there, I believe. But see, it's like, that don't make any sense. Why? It's in the middle of the city. Okay, it wasn't in the city in 30 AD. By 70 AD, it is inside the city. In fact, here, this is not it. It's inside the city. By the time 325, it's inside the city, but also it's covered with a pagan shrine. And so the Christians say Jesus was crucified there, and they point to a place inside the city, and they point to a place that's covered up by a pagan shrine. It's like, well, that's not a very good choice. But they remember, again, they remember from, you know, the stories. And so they excavated. And what Constantine is going to do, I've got this here for you to see this. This is bedrock. This is the site of Mount of Olives. See, that picture, I'm standing up here looking at Jerusalem this way. This is you're walking the bedrock or the ground of the Kidron Valley right here. Then they carve into the stone. This tomb was there when he says, your whitewashed sepulchres, this was the tomb. But you see right here, they cut out that square and they didn't put that in there. That's carved like I said the other night, Mount Rushmore. That's part of the stone. They just built a building out of stone. That is what Constantine is going to do. This is also, there's several tombs right along there. Okay, here it is again. There's a close-up view. You can see how the walls are built there. It's cut out and decorated. There's another one. See that cap right there? That you can see right there. You can see that cap right there? That's this, and that's me standing there. And then you can see the wall. Cut out. That's all bedrock, just decorated bedrock. That's what Constantine's going to do to Jesus' tomb, the little area that you go in. He's going to carve everything away on this side, and just have a little sepulcher, a little building where Jesus' burial place is going to be. That's what Constantine's going to do. And here it is. Here's the dome. Here's Calvary. This is 325. This is Calvary where the stone was. They built a basilica out here so you sit in church service and look out your window at Calvary. And then behind that is a rotunda, and inside there is one of those little buildings that he carved out of the quarry, and that was that. So here it is again. Here's the sepulcher. Here's Calvary right here. Okay. There's this one. Today, you go in there. His got tore down by the Persians. Today, you go in this door right here. You can go up these stairs. And you can go up here. There's a Latin and a Greek altar. And you can see Calvary's stone, the top of the stone here. You walk across here. Here's where the tomb is. Back in here, you see right here, the first century tombs right here. I'm going to show you. This is the floor plan of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This is me right here underneath the Greek altar touching. That's Calvary's stone right there. See, it's built up over it. That you can actually touch it. You can. I'm touching Calvary stone. Like I said on Monday night, trying to be funny. Here's a piece. I chipped off a piece of it. No, but I didn't. But that's that. Now look how close it is. That's Calvary. There's the tomb. Now I'm standing right up here is where I was touching. See, you can see Calvary in there. See that goes up over the Calvary stone. I'm up there touching that stone. You walk down the stairway and walk through here, and the tomb is right there. So it's like, there's Calvary. I'm standing right here touching. That's how close it's under the two domes. And you can't see it real good, but right? There's two domes right there. It's in one building, even today. That's the way it used to look. The wall, 30 AD, Calvary, the road coming into the city, and the garden with the abandoned quarry, Joseph Arimathea. Now, again, I'm going to show you some tombs in just a moment that are still there from that time period. That's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That's Calvary over this part. There's the tomb right there. See, that's a little rotunda, the little building he carved out of the stone. Now, the Muslims are going to come in around 1000 AD, and they're going to crush that little building, cover everything up, just crush it. And the Christians are going to come back, and the Crusaders are going to have a victory, win Jerusalem. They're going to pull all that rubble out, and they're going to find what was still left was the part of the burial bench and a couple of the walls of that rotunda, that little building. This is the back of it, right back here. This is built on top of it. But this was the original. This is very small. This is about this big. This is the trim, the baseboard, the molding going around the whole Constantine's. This is the original Constantine's Sepulchre. This is all broken off at that point and covered up. The Crusaders took it out. It's right there. In fact, if you look right here, that's me reaching underneath or touching it. This is the tomb. They had to rebuild it. This is not the original. They had to rebuild it. But the burial bench is right in there, which has been covered up. But this is where it was originally. Now I'm inside the tomb of Christ. And what you look at right here, none of this is original. This is a limestone bench put on there in the 1500s. And I said it before, and I hate to repeat myself. I don't mind repeating myself. I hate you have to hear me repeat it. But see, that's the other side. The molding's on the other side. See, that I am touching the other side of that molding on the back side. This is from the 1500s, a burial bench. National Geographic, a couple years ago, a scientific excavation, not churches, not the Catholics, not, you know, it was National Geographic, who, as you know, is not like real big on Christian promotion. They went in there under full supervision. Everybody's watching. I mean, this is a tightly monitored. There's like 15 different Christian groups in there, and they're all very particular about. You know, just imagine going to church with a bunch of Christians. Okay, now going to church with 15 different churches meeting in the same building. It's like if there's more than 25 people, I get stressed out. Now put in 25 different denominations all in the same building with all different protocols. It's like, oh my gosh. That's it. And now it'll be National Geographic Day. We're going to come into your church. We're going to excavate your church. It's like, oh, but they pulled it off. They pulled this stone off. This is science. This, you can read this. You can watch the video. They pulled this off, and they found another gray marble limestone, marble burial plate with a Crusader cross carved on it. They pulled that off, but they had to undo the gypsum glue that was like a concrete that was concrete mix holding on that from the Crusade from 1000 AD. They took that off and they found the original limestone bench, that the bedrock. They got down to the bedrock. So that this is 1500. They found the 1000, and then they found the 30 AD limestone bench. And I'll talk about that in a moment too. This is now the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that building right there. There's Calvary. I told you I could go way to the back here behind where the caves were. Right here. You see this right here? Those are still in the back. This is indeed a burial place from the first century. Those are the kokim that they'd slide the bodies in or the ossuaries in there. There it is right there. So that's limestone. It's black like that because of 2,000 years of candles being burnt in there. So that's why it's definitely got its own smell. There it is right there again. Oh, that's all I've got right there. Oh, man, there's a great picture that would explain this. And I'll quit. Oh, there it is right here. See this? This is inside. There's the burial bench that you can see today that was placed there in the 1500s, been taken off. They found the limestone. Right here. Here's a drawing of it. See the yellow? The yellow is all original limestone. So the Muslims crushed this around, I don't know, 900 or something. Crusaders won it back. They rebuilt the Holy Sepulchre. This is still there, the original burial bench. That's the gray marble slab was attached to the 30 AD limestone burial bench with gypsum mortar, scientifically dated to be from 335 to 345 AD. So that's Byzantine. Okay, so I said that'd be 345 that was put on there to protect limestone. 1500s, they put this one on there. It hadn't been moved from 1555 until 2020 when they took that off. What's underneath here? This with a cross on it. They take it off. They see the limestone bench. But they also found out that coming up these walls are just panels, just to kind of give the image of what used to be there. This right here, this limestone and this limestone, part of this wall and part of this wall are original of Constantine's and Jesus' original burial case. Now, Jesus' story is not over, as you know. Mount of Olives, he's going to come back the same way he left. Ezekiel sees the glory coming from the east back into the temple. Paul talks about Jesus appearing out of heaven to fight against the Antichrist. Got Revelation. He says, every eye will see him. This same Jesus who was resurrected, ascended, is coming back. And this is, we're in the middle of the story. I mean, it's like, I'm going to put a pause on this because the story's not done yet. Because he is going to come back. It's not an ancient history. This is, we are in the middle. We're in an age between the resurrection and the return of Jesus Christ. And it's nice to have this background because the story gets even better as we continue. I'll pray and we're finished. Father, do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the assurance that Jesus Christ is alive. And we do thank you that we have the opportunity to place faith and have the transforming power of the Holy Spirit in our own lives, that we can live again, but we can also be transformed into the image of Jesus Christ and serve you at this time in history. We do look forward to our future and ask that we would share it with others, that they too may join the kingdom of God. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for coming.